Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Independence unfortunately comes and goes, frequently under the guise of independence for other people. And independence is today's topic. In this, the first of a two-part Radio Curious series recorded on June 29th and broadcast on July 4th and July 11th, 2007, we visit the concept of independence as seen from the Lakota point of view. The Lakota Nation was made up of the largest known group of North American Native people and encompassed a large portion of the northern plains in what is now Montana, Wyoming, North and South Dakota. Our guest is Joseph M. Marshall III, author of The Day the World Ended at Little Bighorn, A Lakota History. Growing up on the Rosebud Sioux Indian Reservation, where his first language was Lakota, Marshall is a historian and storyteller and author whose works share the history of his people. I spoke with Joseph Marshall in this, the first program on this series, when he was visiting San Francisco, California. We began our conversation when I asked him to describe what turned out to be the largest and last gathering of the Lakota people when they met at Little Bighorn in July of 1876.
Yeah, it was not only the largest gathering in memory, but it was, as you say, the last time that they gathered in that fashion. There were a lot of reasons before 1876 to gather that way. Much of it was usually some kind of religious ceremonial occasion, primarily for a Sundance. And there were those kinds of large gatherings where thousands and thousands of people came together about every 4 years. Every summer, somebody did a Sundance somewhere, but the large kind of gatherings occurred every 4 years. And actually, there was one before, maybe 11 years before, that was large also. That was in the area of where Casper, Wyoming is now, but it was not as large as the Little Bighorn gathering, and that was the last time that that many people came together, 8,000 to 10,000 people, we were told, and that's a lot when you consider that probably the total population of the nation at the time was probably about 25,000.
The Lakota Nation.
Yes.
When they would gather, how was word passed as to the time and place of the gathering?
Well, people generally knew that it would be a time. This would be the summer. This would be the year for such a gathering. So they anticipated receiving word from whoever was going to be sort of the one who was bringing everybody together. In this case, it was Sitting Bull. He had sent out messengers from what is now North Central South Dakota, South Central North Dakota, where his people, the Hunkpapa Lakota, were at the time. He sent out young men on horseback carrying pipes to other parts of the area, the region where most of the Lakota people were, saying, it's time to get together. We're going to get together this and such at this place, beginning in the moon when the geese return or whatever. And it was actually messages delivered to the people.
There's a lot of information packed in there. In the moon when the geese return, I believe, refers to a certain time of the year based on how the animals traveled.
Exactly. It was the names of that we had for the months of the year is based on natural events. And not everybody had the same name. Another Lakota group could have a slightly different variation or different name, but the moon when the geese return is roughly April. It's when the geese came back from the south and the winter was over and they were flying overhead going back up north to Canada. So that was the name for that was based on that phenomenon.
So when 8,000 to 10,000 people would gather, that's quite a few folks. Tell us about the activities of the gathering before we get to the substance or the reason to discuss, the reason to meet. I'm just getting everybody together.
Sure, getting everybody together was you know, it was not so much a nightmare. People had been doing this for a long, this sort of thing for a long, long time, even before the time of horses. So there was a protocol, there was a process involved, and people knew what that process was. And it was made easier physically because people lived, when they came together as different bands or sub-bands, they all lived in a precise location. It doesn't matter whether the camp was at Little Bighorn or at Goose Creek or anywhere else. They all lived in the same location. Visualize, if you can, a capital C, the letter C, with the opening of the C toward the east. And on that circle, everybody lived in the same place every time they came together. For example, Sitting Bull's own people, the Hunkpapa, their name literally meant those who camp at the end. So their village circles would be at the bottom end of that C as it came up, and they would always be in that same place every time. So those kinds of protocols made it easier when people came together. It didn't matter whether there were 400 people or 4,000 or 8,000, as this encampment eventually came to be. So people were used to it, and they had done it before. So they would come together and do the same thing. And they would visit. They would put up their lodges. They would make sure that there was water nearby, that they were in an area where there was plenty of game so that they could find fresh food day in and day out. In 1876, one of the concerns was that there would be enough grazing for the horses because it had a substantial number of horses. So it was just like everyday life anywhere else, except that you got to see people you hadn't seen maybe since the year before or maybe 2 years before, and you would catch up on family news and what had been going on with the people who had been up in one part of the nation as opposed to somebody who had been somewhere else. And so it was an important, not only a ceremonial occasion, but it was an important social occasion as well.
Well, Joseph M. Marshall III, author of The Day the World Ended at Little Bighorn, tell us about the everyday life of the Lakota people at times when they weren't gathering every 4 years.
Yeah, well, they were busy making a living. I mean, you know, getting along in their communities, in their lives, in whatever part of the nation they lived in. They were busy getting along every day, day in and day out, busy surviving. The Lakota were a nomadic hunting culture, and they were nomadic hunters even before the horse came along. So after we came, even before we came onto the Northern Plains, we were hunters, and we made a living by procuring game animals for their hide and for their meat. And, of course, once we got onto the plains, then our biggest resource became the bison. And the bison was the source of food, shelter, and clothing. So most of the time was spent procuring materials to survive, to food to eat, the hides that could be processed into clothing, and the buffalo hides that could be processed into the hide coverings for the teepees. And so people just spent their time processing raw materials or going out and hunting for it. And once in a while, the men as the warriors would go out and patrol the area to make sure enemies weren't coming in. And in the meantime, you know, young men would court young women, the children would play their games, and all those kind of everyday processes would go on all the time.
Well, tell us about some of the training of the children, perhaps the way the boys became skilled marksmen with a bow and arrow.
Yeah, it was an interesting process, and I think in many ways a fun process. Looking back on my own childhood with my grandfather, I can say that it was a fun process. I mean, there was a lot of serious stuff to learn, but it was done in a way that is quite different from the way school is today. It was a one-on-one process for both boys and girls. One person, in the case of girls, it would be an aunt or an older sister or a mother or a grandmother or a friend of the family. In the case of the boys, it was much the same way. A father, a grandfather, an uncle, somebody would take that young person under their wings and begin to teach them the fundamentals of things that they had to know when they reached adulthood. In order to, for the boys, it would be, they would had to be two things. They had to be the hunter, and they had to be the warrior, or the provider and a protector. So they had to learn the skills. They had to be taught the skills with which to carry out those social responsibilities. And it meant things like shooting a bow and arrow, and even making a bow and arrow to begin with. But one of the interesting ways in which boys were taught marksmanship was after they learned the fundamentals of shooting a bow, the teacher would send them out in the summer to look for grasshoppers, and they would tell them, go shoot a grasshopper. And, of course, if you know anything about grasshoppers, they're very fast and they fly erratically, and you can't ever tell which direction they're going to go. So if you could draw a bead on a grasshopper, you would increase your skill level over a period of time. So that was one way that they learned marksmanship.
When they would shoot a grasshopper, I guess the grasshopper wouldn't be flying or moving at the moment.
Oh, yeah, definitely. That was the whole point, to try to shoot a moving grasshopper.
Did you have an experience learning to do that?
Oh, yes. I never did hit a grasshopper, but I came close on several occasions. But the whole point was to teach you how to develop a good eye for shooting and sighting in.
How's your skill these days?
Probably better than it was when I was 12, but I'm not as good as my grandfather was when he was, even in his 60s and early 70s, he was quite a marksman.
Was he your mentor?
He was. He was definitely my mentor. He was the guy who taught me how to make bows and arrows, how to shoot them, what they were all about, the philosophy that went along with it, and so forth. And he was my mentor in a lot of other ways as well.
Can you tell us about your grandfather?
My grandfather's name was, he was my maternal grandfather, my mother's father. His name was Albert Tuhawk. And he had the name Tuhawk because his mother, his own father had died when he was about 8, and so his mother remarried, and the man she remarried had the name Tuhawk. And before that, his mother's name was Little Bird. So he had two traditional names, Little Bird and Tuhawk. And so when it came time to be enrolled with the Rosebud Sioux tribe, he was enrolled as Albert Tuhawk. And he was born in 1888, just a few years after the Rosebud Sioux Reservation officially became a reservation. And he grew up primarily on the western and northern part of the reservation, and he went to public school, to a day school, but only went to the third grade. His predominant language was Lakota, and he could communicate in English, but he never did speak English to me in all of my boyhood. And he and my grandmother were married when my grandmother was 20, in 1920. And they had two children, my mother and my uncle. Both are still alive. My grandparents died years ago, but both my mother and my uncle are still alive.
So share with us some of the things that your grandfather taught you.
He taught me the language, obviously. He told me a lot of stories about family and about history in general. He taught me about his father, who was a participant at the Battle of the Little Bighorn as an 18-year-old boy. And so from that focal point, I began to learn the stories of that particular battle. But he taught me, culturally, the responsibilities of a man in Lakota culture and all of those kinds of insights, even until I was a young adult.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Joseph M. Marshall III, the author of The Day the World Ended at Little Bighorn. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Joseph Marshall, you mentioned the history of the Lakota people. Can you take us back prior to the time that horses were part of the environment and give us a sense of the culture, the timing, the indigenous nomadic culture of your people?
My ancestors were nomadic peoples even before the coming of the horse, in that they moved around from season to season, predominantly following the game animals that they depended on for a livelihood, for food and shelter and clothing.
Among those game animals, which were they, and how did they make the clothing from them?
In the beginning, probably it was elk and deer and those kinds of animals. And then when we came onto the northern plains, then it was bison. And the hides would be used, especially for animals like elk and deer and mountain goat, and antelope, the lighter hides would be used for clothing, for shirts, for trousers, for dresses, and the thicker hides like bison and elk would be used for moccasins, especially moccasin soles. And of course, it was the bison hides that became the hide coverings for the teepee that we're all so familiar with, the conical teepee. Before the coming of the horse, the teepee design was basically the same. It was conical, but it wasn't as large and it didn't stand as tall. And it was probably made out of elk hide or something like that, moose hide or deer hide. And they were large enough to maybe hold four or five people at the most comfortably, meaning they were probably about 8 to 10 to 12 feet across at the most and stood maybe 8 to 10 feet tall. And the hide coverings were in two pieces so that they could be folded up and carried by dogs, because before the coming of horses, dogs were the beasts of burden, and they were used not only for hunting but to help transport material. So that was the lifestyle before. And
in the transport of the material, it was on drag poles.
It was on long drag poles. They were probably, you know, they were the teepee poles, and they were, you know, they were used to double up as drag poles, and they would form sort of a tripod that would be tied across the back or the withers of a dog, and the dog had a harness to help him pull it, and on as the poles spread out in the back, and over that, those poles was put a platform, and on that platform was loaded all kinds of materials, household goods, the teepees themselves, other poles, and so forth. And that's, you know, there were a lot of dogs because there were a lot of stuff that had to be hauled.
Let's talk about the wintertime. Were the teepees adequate to keep people warm in the blizzards and in the cold northern plains?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they developed a system for insulating. First of all, the hides themselves were smoked so that they were moisture resistant, so that they would not get wet as easily. And there was an inner lining. On the inside of the teepee, there was a lining that was probably three-quarters of the way up. And in between, in the inner and outer lining, in the late summer and early autumn, the people would pick a lot of grass, and they would stuff that grass in between the two linings, and that would insulate the home. And the shape of the home itself was such that they would have one central fire, and they didn't need a roaring fire to keep themselves warm, just enough to, you know, keep the air comfortable, and they were quite comfortable.
Are you indicating then that in the winter months they wouldn't move from where they set up in the fall?
Oh, absolutely, they couldn't, because it would be counterproductive to they would disturb the comfort of the home in the wintertime and the ability to keep it warm. So winter camps were permanent from about late October, early November until sometime in the spring.
What was the food source?
The food source was those, whatever they had managed to hunt and put away, to, you know, the meat that was dried in late autumn, early winter, and that was stored in containers, and that was used as during the winter. And of course, during the winter, the hunters tried to hunt as much as possible to get fresh meat, but they usually had an adequate supply of dried meat on hand.
How about health factors? When a person got sick, what was available?
Available to them were the skills of the medicine man and a variety of medicines that helped to alleviate headaches, stomach aches. There were balms to help heal cuts. There were a variety of medicines and ways to use them. And there were people who were herbalists who were not necessarily medicine men or healers, but there were also the medicine men and healers who were available to help mitigate an illness.
Was there a written language, or was it solely an oral tradition?
It was solely an oral tradition. It was. We never have developed our own alphabet. Now we use the English alphabet to write our language. But so we are an oral tradition, going back God knows how far.
In terms of passing the oral tradition down through the generations, how was that done?
It was done in the family, primarily, from one parent, or usually a grandparent, would tell stories to the grandchildren and teach them things like quill work or making clothing or how to make a moccasin or bows and arrows for the boys and tools and weapons and so forth. But along with those kinds of lessons came the stories about what the meaning was for each of those objects, for example. And then there was the larger issue of community history, or, you know, a band history, and usually those were the responsibility of one or two people in the community who remembered the stories, and then they would make those stories available to everybody else, and they would be passed down in a form of just basic stories or information.
In making the story available and in passing it along, was that were the children to whom the stories were told just picking it up and creating their own interpretation, or were they required to repeat it back in a precise form?
No, they were required for the most part to accept the stories as they were told to them, because that's where the basis of reality and truth was, and not to change it or enhance it, whether you liked the story or not. You had to take it as it was given to you and pass it on as it was given to you later on when you were a parent or a grandparent, and nobody was allowed to deviate from the story. Because for one thing, everybody knew the story. Everybody in the community, in the family, in the band knew the story. So if you deviated from it, somebody would know.
Can you tell us one or two of the stories that are important to you?
One of the stories that was important to me in growing up was the story of my great-grandfather, who was a combatant at the Little Bighorn. And when I first heard it, when I was just maybe 4, 5, or 6 years old, and you know, at that age, you think it's just a story. You don't realize that it has significant family and history, family history and community history behind it. And at first, it was a story just about a young man who traveled a long way and then participated in the battle against long knives or soldiers. And then as I got older, then my grandfather would add more detail about what happened, the kind of weapon he carried, where he was in the battle. And by the time I was 12 or 13, I knew the story of my great-grandfather down to the detail of where he was when the battle started, what he did during the battle, and what happened after his part of the battle. And he essentially... later in his life, before he died of Spanish influenza, was sort of ashamed of what he did, not because he dishonored himself, but because he didn't kill anybody in the battle. What he did do was rescue 8 or 9 wounded warriors and take them back to the encampment so they could be treated. And he didn't think that was anything worth bragging about. But that's, you know, that gives me an insight into the kind of man he was. And so that was one of the most important stories to me.
In a subsequent edition of Radio Curious, we'll be talking with Joseph M. Marshall III about the day the world ended at the Little Bighorn, which is also the name of his book, A Lakota History. Joseph Marshall, what is the Lakota creation legend?
There's a couple of them. One of the one that I like is the one that says we came out of a hole in the Black Hills. We were living underground. The people were underground, and they were curious about what was going on above them because they knew there was a world above them. And so some curious ones opened a hole, looked out onto the world, and saw this lush environment of green grass and blue sky and game and everything else. And they decided they wanted to come out of the hole and live on the surface. And so most of them did. But one person stayed behind because she was not so sure about what the life would be like on the surface, and she stayed behind. The people went out, and they flourished for a time, and they spread out over the country, not all over the world, but in that different part of the region. They made it, you know, home for themselves and so forth, and they flourished to a point. And then things turned difficult. There were hard times. There was starvation. There was drought. All those things that made life difficult. And she, the person who stayed behind, would look out every now and to see how her relatives were doing. And at that point, she looked out and saw that they were having a hard time. Life had gotten really, really difficult, and people were having a hard time finding things to eat, and there was disease, and people were dying. So she prayed to the Creator, and the Creator told her to come out so that she could help her relatives. And when she came out, she turned into a bison, a buffalo, and the people hunted her, and she multiplied. She became more and more, more of her, and then the people hunted her and ate her flesh. And from then on, we became Ptetraoyate, or the bison people. And so that's my favorite creation story.
Does that creation story explain how the people came to be under the level of the earth before they came out?
No, it was just there. It was just there. There was really no fundamental explanation as to why and how they got there. It was just another form of existence.
So the oral tradition, if we were to accept the concept that people, our species, Homo sapiens sapien, originated or developed into who we are in North Central Africa and then began walking through various parts of the world,
mm-hmm.
Across the Bering Strait and into North and then South America, the oral tradition doesn't include that?
It probably does in a way, because, you know, the Australian Aborigines have what they call a before time. And I think this, if you look at that story and the fact that the existence underground before they came out is never really defined or delineated, that's the before time. That was the existence that was okay, but is not what they wanted ultimately. So they rose up out of that, and it's the rising up of from a place that you didn't like or weren't satisfied with to something higher. That's the metaphor there. So in a way, it really doesn't acknowledge all of the things that we think we know today about how humankind developed, but at the same time, it doesn't ignore it either. There was a before time before the people came out of the hole.
Well, Joseph M. Marshall III, author of The Day the World Ended at Little Bighorn, A Lakota History, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Oh, I'm into reading a book called, it's by Vine Deloria, and I think the title is The World We Used to Live In. And it's the subtitle is Remembering the Powers of Medicine Men. And he talks about the importance of the traditional healer in Lakota culture, the medicine men, that we still have among us. But it was different in the old days than it is now.
Well, Joseph M. Marshall, thank you for joining us on Radio Curious.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Joseph M. Marshall III is the author of The Day the World Ended at Little Bighorn, A Lakota History. The book he recommends is The World We Used to Live In, Remembering the Powers of Medicine Men by Vine Deloria. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. And the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.